this is a little bit of the history of metaphysical thinking. And we see again that the metaphysical concepts of man, how he evaluates his position in the world, his position towards himself, towards nature, towards divinity, is the decisive point from which all other things follow. If a change occurs in this basic concept, everything else will change. It will change first without being recognized. When a change like Descartes, Spinoza's and Leibniz change and Hobbes, because theirs is a common change, they all achieved it, takes place, namely in this central structural thinking, a change is made by putting consciousness as the highest development of nature. That means bringing man's, making man's logos inferior to the logos of things. Then it is first not noticed. Nevertheless, the change that comes about is an irresistible and permanent change, which cannot be stopped anymore, except when another change occurs in the center. A change in the center can be absolutely unobtrusive. It is not recognized. But it means that first the things around the center begin to change a little bit. Then towards the periphery, and the periphery is an infinite. Changes get into bigger and bigger and more catastrophic movements. A change in the center is a change of everything imaginable for man. That is the importance of metaphysical ideas. They decide the whole set of all the other ideas of man, be they artistic or scientific or personal or whatever. This freedom of man to fool around with definitions and ideas about his own position in the world and in being is his most dangerous freedom. So, but also the most exciting one and the most promising one. So it is very well understandable that as soon as such a change had been made, people tried to stick to it as long as possible, because the horror of revolutions is before all our eyes in politics, also the possibilities of revolution. But the fear of changing one's own basic thinking and approach to everything is so tremendous in man that he shrinks back from it as long as he possibly can, and he is right, because it can bring about the greatest possible changes. Nevertheless, we are already in the change. We only have the negative side of the change. We cannot help ourselves anymore. We just have to suffer the events. So it's better to try to see the change and to make it consciously. We have seen that self-consciousness, that what Spinoza called so lightly an illusion that the stone would produce, the illusion of free will, we have seen that that illusion could only come about by self-consciousness, but self-consciousness supposes a self. this self-consciousness that made all our consciousness in the Western development possible, we are again concerned with, in order to see how other scientific, artistic, and so on thinking can be derived from metaphysical thinking. The illusion of Spinoza, the illusion of that stone which would make the stone a human being and not a thinking stone, as he thought, and which makes also that we are not thinking stones but human beings, which is quite a different thing. This illusion is the capability of free imagination. It can be a delusion. We can produce delusions by it. To produce a delusion means to use one's own free will to such a degree that one overcomes by it every kind of reasoning, every concern with reality. The best delusion, the purest delusion, of course, is the delusion of grandeur. That means the delusion of the insane person who is able by will, because this is will, to fence himself off from all the world and from all reality in order to keep his individuality safe and unhurt, and will then end up with an idea fix, which is a perfect delusion because it has nothing whatsoever to do with reality anymore. So an illusion can be, on the one side, a delusion of that kind. That means man's capability to cut himself entirely up from every condition except mere physical conditions, like that he has to die or to eat, which the insane person has too to do. But otherwise to cut himself off entirely from the world and from all mental reality and reality of impressions. And on the other hand, using this capability of illusion for creating an image. An image that uses observed conditional trends of reality to a certain degree, but guesses from there by introducing the will to change this reality, creating an image, an idea, and if the idea is an adequate synthesis of this imaginative will for meaning and exact observation of facts of reality, this idea or this image can be realized by man. Creative imagination, productive imagination in this sense, is the real sign of freedom. This what sets our consciousness apart, makes our consciousness possible by self-consciousness, is the mere technical thing that we can produce an illusion, because the delusion as well as the creative imagination are illusions. That means they are free thinking. We will not understand this turn around which we try to make by saying that the condition for consciousness is self-consciousness and not the other way around. That our error since the 17th century has always been to think that self-consciousness can spring out either as an illusion or as a real product of reality, out of the logos of nature, out of consciousness itself. We will not understand that if we do not take it up as to a few other points which are nearly related to it. Our consciousness, as far as we apply it scientifically, moves according to the rule, not the law, the rule set by us, the rule of cause and effect. We cannot make any real observations as to the nature of things, as to occurrences, if we do not apply the basic rule of cause and effect. Now, according to this modern Western philosophy, we become aware or conscious of cause and effect because we ourselves are in a line of cause and effect, like everything else. What distinguishes us from everything else is only that we are the ones who, by consciousness, become aware of cause and effect and can distinguish them. This is as well believed as a possibility as the possibility of consciousness itself growing out of an entirely unconscious world. We are not even sure about this so-called rule, or as we still call it, law of cause and effect. It seems now that in inner atomic occurrences, this rule or law does not apply. That makes us suspicious that it might be a rule that prevails only in the human mind, that otherwise there is no such thing as cause and effect, that the chain of occurrences is an unbroken chain in nature, and that in this unbroken chain only one rule prevails, the rule of sequence, and that nobody can say when this sequence will stop or not stop. Scientists have become in our days very careful about those things. They formulate physical laws and say this will hold true in so and so much billion of cases, except the one case where it might not hold true. Because they have become aware that the chains of occurrences which seem to us which are unbroken chains are nevertheless chains which have an end somewhere, somehow. That the guarantee that they are absolutely interchained with other chains of occurrences is not so sure anymore for us. That's how far the scientists go. The philosopher has to go a step farther because he's not interested in that question. He is interested in the question, is not perhaps the necessity which we invented becoming aware of one fact with Heraclitus, which we could prove, namely the fact that not according to laws, but according to rules, natural occurrences happen. We draw from that, we have been drawing from that the conclusion that therefore all those occurrences must be interconnected. This came in again by this assumption that everything is one, which by the way Heraclitus thought himself too, which we cannot believe anymore, especially in the time of relativity. Everything cannot be one. This metaphysical assumption has to be rejected now. So we are not even sure of the thoroughgoing connection between all those chains of events. We approach more and more a state of mind where we see mass occurrences which move according to certain rules, but through each other, not necessarily interconnected. The assumption that we will finally reach a definite set of those rules goes far. Both Asiatic philosophers we have considered are, in our sense, originators and liberators of the human mind. If that is so, then the awakening to essential freedom and concepts of freedom and creativeness has taken place in Asia as well as it took place in the West. And there is no sense in discrimination of Asia as to this point. Without both thinkers, though they were unknown in the West for a long time and we cannot prove direct influences, nevertheless it is most probable that the thinker who makes the next decisive step upwards, namely Zarathustra, must have had certain knowledge of basic positions of Indian philosophy, at least. We can try to prove that later. But even if this connection cannot be proved and is not there, then still they belong together as necessary steps of this development of the human mind. And that can be shown. Nevertheless, there is a distinction between the Asiatic thinkers we consider here and the European thinkers. The bridge to them would Zarathustra be, because Zarathustra, as a Persian, we can consider either, in a way. The distinction between those two pure Asiatic thinkers and the others is still a very decisive one. They were liberators, but in the form of bringing deliverance. That means negative liberation. The fact that Buddhism has not really, has been thrown out of India finally, the fact that neither Buddhism nor Taoism in China ever became real political factors in Asia. The only political factor surviving in Asia, as far as we know, is Confucianism, which then made its peace with Bolshevism. Very fast, it seems, as far as we can see now in the modern development. Neither Taoism nor Buddhism had real political influence. And this is no accident. Both thinkers limited the range of human freedom and creativeness of which they conceived, which they discovered. Limited that range very much. We have seen that Laozi teaches a private life, so to speak. This is not retirement from the world, as Buddha's teaching is. But it is a private life. It is, he has been called an individualistic anarchist in Western thought. This is, of course, a funny mistake. Lyotzi is a family philosopher. The breaking up of the musical society in his time and creating new kingdoms in war with each other permanently, his hatred against the teaching of Confucius and people like him who tried to moralize and to give good reasons for the existence of those kingdoms, changing society back and forth permanently. This hatred explains itself by his insight into the absolute hopelessness of political action, creative political action, within a society that had lived in the myth. This society, for instance, Indian society, but also Chinese, but Indian more so, was used to a division of creative labor, so to speak. In India, the Brahmins were the highest caste, but they were not the ruling caste. The ruling caste were the warriors. But the warriors and the feudal lords were despised by the Brahmins. They followed only their fate, which was a minor one. But they had to say, a Brahmin would never have interfered with their politics as to the society they ruled. So for intellectuals, even for free intellectuals like Buddha, it would have been almost impossible to interfere with that. He could only create a certain society of intellectuals within this society in order, so to speak, just to save, to deliver from this wheel of existence and being of this society certain persons and a circle of persons, let's say a circle of friends or of companions better. Lyotzi could only liberate the family circle with friends. Both did not have political aims. Both broke one essential feature of the myth, namely the blind belief in fate, but they both still accepted fate. They only made an island for human beings possible where they could get away from fate, could circumvent fate, so to speak. But otherwise there was no think, no thought in them that the world could be changed. The world and its fate remains unchangeable. Only man can find within this world a certain island of freedom, be it in this benevolent tolerance, which is merely private of Lyotzi, or be it in this retirement from the world into the innermost human mind itself and the circle of companions that dwell with one in this circle on this island. So both were only able to conceive of liberation but not of freedom really. Freedom is active. There is no activity in that sense in them. It is restricted to the inner activity or to activities in small circles. The development, the discovery of reason, which takes place with both of them. They discover the human capability of reasoning. But this reasoning takes place only in one person. They can teach it, they can transmit it to a certain degree, but we do not hear of dialogues between Buddha and his disciples. We do not hear of dialogues of Lyotzi. They didn't care for dialogues. There was no real communication. This communication was not possible because it can develop only when the awakening for the political possibilities of man has already taken place. Political possibilities means here only, philosophically, that men have become aware that they are free to build free communities with each other for a common purpose of changing things. As long as this has not become clear, the philosopher, deep thinker as he might be, is not able to conceive of freedom in a positive sense, except for human inwardness. Those are the limits of both those thinkers. That makes also for the fact that in them a difference between the concept of meaning and the concept of truth has not yet taken place. In both, those concepts are absolutely identical. If there is meaning in the world, this is the truth. Truth itself independently does not exist. It exists only within that definite meaning that the world or being might have. Here comes in the funny fact that in this one point, Hindu thinking, philosophy, the metaphysical development of philosophical thought in Hindu thinking in India, that thinking that the Buddha had to break down in order to reach the first step of freedom, the first position of freedom, of possible freedom, that just in this thinking, there's one indication, almost like the outcry of hope, of a world, mystical world, totally submerged in this cosmological speculation, those mythological systems, which always tell human beings what to do in every given moment. And that is a theory of truth. A theory of truth that is so far-reaching and modern that we even have not considered it yet among our analysis, in our analysis of different concepts of truth in all the development of Western philosophy. But the concept of truth that, strangely enough, turns up full-fledged in the next thinker of free thought, namely Zarathustra. If he got it from Hindu thinking by tradition, we do not know. He makes a clear concept of it, which we will consider in the beginning of the next semester. But the Hindus have given a definite indication of it. This indication you find in anecdotes of Hindu thinking, of Hindu tradition, quoted in Henry Zimmer's Philosophies of India. The first thing is that at the time of Asoka, Asoka was the king shortly after the time of Alexander, who tried first to establish a great empire in India. He was a common soldier who rose to kingdom. And he tried to make Buddhism, by the way, a state religion. But this whole empire broke down very fast, so he was one of the greatest kings that ever lived. And it proved, was shown that Buddhism never could become a state religion, never even could become an organized religion with definite aims, because it did lack entirely the inherent political sense.